from deep inside your radio.
From the edge of America. From the home of the homeless. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to another edition of Le Show. On this week's broadcast, more of the Fog Watch. Some fine apologies of the week. You know Geraldo apologized. We'll find out how the Iraqi legal system is being reconstituted. And we'll catch up with Dewey Gordon. And more on this week's edition of Le Show. Stay tuned, won't I? But first, as is my wartime wont, let me read the trades for you. From Current, the trade magazine of public broadcasting, Hot Over Heartburn Credit. I'll read it for you. Just days after announcing plans for a comprehensive review of its underwriting practices, NPR, National Public Radio, ignited a firestorm of criticism from stations incensed over a spot it accepted for Nexium, a heartburn pill. To many, the credit seems to conclude with a call to action. Ask your doctor, in violation of FCC underwriting guidelines. Quote, the inability of NPR management to say the simple words, no, we can't say that, is very troubling, says Jerry Weston, president of the Public Radio Partnership in Louisville, Kentucky. NPR should have the backbone to say no when something comes into them that's illegal. NPR defends the spot, claiming it got informal approval from an unidentified advisor at the FCC. The commission believes the language is non-promotional because Ask Your Doctor directs listeners to seek more information, says Barbara Hall, NPR's VP of Development, in a memo to stations. That reasoning wasn't enough to satisfy many development, i.e. fundraising, professionals who posted angry emails last week to public radio's internet discussion groups slamming NPR for forcing the spot on local stations. What strikes me about NPR accepting the Nexium spot is how easily they could have been rewritten to eliminate the call to action, says Steve Kripinski, underwriting sales manager for Detroit Public Radio. What about information is available from your doctor? PRI and other producers also accept underwriting spots that rile station sensibilities, says the general manager of WOI in Ames, Iowa. For a long time, Marketplace's musical theme included an echo of the jingle from its underwriter, General Electric. Says Gray Smith, director of corporate support at Public Radio Partnership, there's absolutely no scenario in which Ask Your Doctor is not a call to action. According to Alan Myers of the FCC's Media Bureau, FCC rules don't prohibit a call to action at all. It simply prohibits promotion. But according to the FCC's own website, announcements containing a call to action are not permissible, such as, stop by our showroom to see a model. Even an informational call to action is intended to get listeners to buy something. Kripinski says, why else would Nexium want you to ask your doctor? Good question. Occurs to all of us when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature. This is Le Show, and news from the rear, ladies and gentlemen, because you've had too much news from the front. Me, that's my personal opinion. But what do I know? I just don't work here. First of all, just a couple of questions before we delve. It appears now, having seen the wave of congratulatory, I'm going to use a term of art here and call it journalism, on American media regarding the amazing, amazing victory in Iraq, as amazing as Mike Tyson knocking out a club fighter. Exactly that amazing. In the wake of that, of course, an awful lot of, as I say, congratulatory, quote, journalism, unquote, about our mission of liberation. Some Iraqis are happy. Others who've had relatives killed or who ran museums of antiquities where there are no longer any antiquities because they all got smashed by looters, they're not quite as happy. But, you know, as Donald Rumsfeld... Oh, speaking of which, Donald Rumsfeld. I'm over here for a minute. Because if I forget this, I'm going to kick myself. As Donald Rumsfeld pointed out this week, this is all untidiness that we're experiencing right now. It's like, you know, he didn't make this comparison, but it's like dust weevils under the couch, basically. Here's actually what he said. No, that's not what he said. It's fun being in a new studio, isn't it? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is. Here's what Rumsfeld said.
8 headlines that talked about chaos, violence, unrest, and it just was henny penny. The sky is falling. I've never seen anything like it.
Ladies and gentlemen, I checked this out because I thought I was dreaming. It was Chicken Little who said the sky was falling. Henny Penny fell in line afterwards, but it was Chicken Little first. So I think whatever else you can say about Don Rumsfeld, he's confused his nursery rhyme poultry. Which, you know, he's a busy guy. He's got other animals to fry. This is also in the quotes I don't want to forget to share with you before the moving finger writes. One of the major justifications for the war in Iraq before we went in. Now, as I was saying, in the aftermath, the celebratory aftermath, it's all human rights and liberation. Which means what? That Jimmy Carter's foreign policy was right? Wasn't it the Republicans who were always criticizing Jimmy Carter for his fuzzy-headedness because he was emphasizing human rights in his foreign policy? Yes, it was. Thanks for the kids who remembered. But one of the actual justifications advanced before the war began was, of course, weapons of mass destruction. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But another of the justifications advanced frequently by administration spokespeople before the war was that Saddam Hussein was hosting was pals with terrorists. As a matter of fact, several times administration spokespeople said he was hosting terrorists. There was a terrorist training camp set up in northern Iraq. And in the back of my mind, I had a thought, but I didn't voice it at the time. Again, a term of art. Journalists didn't voice it either. But last Sunday on Meet the Press, Paul Wolfowitz, the assistant defense secretary, did voice it.
I think something people need to understand, for the last 12 years, northern Iraq has been more or less free territory, free from the Saddam Hussein regime.
He was pointing that out in a totally different context, ladies and gentlemen, of course. But the point is, the terrorist training camp was in northern Iraq, which Paul Wolfowitz says was free territory, free of Saddam Hussein's control. So whom do we blame for the presence of that terrorist? Do we blame the Kurds? Do we blame, I don't know. But anyway, just a nutty happenstance. Let's say for a moment, shall we, that this is all a great policy. Let's stipulate, as the lawyers say, that this is all cool. That even the grandest definition of this, the remaking of the map of the Middle East, look out Syria, look out Iran, it's all a good idea. It's all going to work. And let's assume further that the administration's domestic tax policy is a good idea and it's going to work. But the premises, let's redraw the map of the Middle East in the case of the foreign policy, and in the case of the domestic policy, let's cut taxes so much that we starve the beast, i.e. shrink the federal government, which is what David Stockman said the purpose of the Reagan tax cuts were. was. And arguably, that's what the purpose of the Bush tax. You know, it's not just to reward his. He can reward his friends a million different ways. Let's be honest. We'll talk about some of those ways in a moment. He doesn't have to lower taxes to help his friends, but it does accomplish one important objective for conservatives. It shrinks the size of the federal. There's less money available for the federal government. Okay, cool. You like that policy? Great. Run on it. Put it to a vote. Don't hide it and then reveal it only after the election. I'm sorry, another term of art. But these policies would have been an excellent subject for discussion during the election campaign. Just me opinionating here. So we're looking at the future of Iraq. And one of the ways to judge how we'll do would be to compare with the aftermath of our last war. Dateline Kabul. No, sorry, Herat, Afghanistan, from the Telegraph of London, a conservative newspaper. Like other former warlords in different regions of the country, the governor of Herat, Ismail Khan, is impervious to many of the demands of Afghanistan's American-backed central government, led by Hamid Karzai in Kabul, which appointed him, a fact which has contributed to growing anarchy and a breakdown of law and order in Afghanistan. More than 15 months since the Taliban regime was declared driven from power in Afghanistan, American-led forces are fighting a resurgence by Taliban supporters in the south. And we're not the only ones who can drop leaflets. Last week, leaflets purporting to bear a message from Mullah Omar, the Taliban's former leader, were secretly spread around the border town of Spin Boldak, a no Bill Riley zone, calling on Afghans to act like Iraqi people and defend your country. Well, that was written early. It was written by the Iraqi information minister, apparently. Contrary to what most people think, we have not shifted to a stabilization mission yet. This is still a war zone, said an American soldier at Bagram. Militant Taliban remnants are part of the problem facing Karzai's government. Almost as challenging is the growing autonomy of prominent, powerful warlords who have more real power than the government they're supposed to serve. In parts of the country beyond the reach of Kabul, Afghanistan is once again reverting to the unruliness for which it was notorious. The murder last week of a Red Cross worker north of Kandahar is only one in a series of security incidents and hijackings that have caused non-governmental aid organizations to pull out of the south of the country. It's not good tourist fodder quite yet. The Taliban have hit American bases and the headquarters of the International Peacekeeping Forces in Kabul. Mullah Dadullah, you got to love that name, Mullah Dadullah, the first senior member of the Taliban to speak publicly since 2001, says, there's been a gap in our activities, but our people have now made contact with each other and are waiting for their commanders and elders to give the order to save our country. Like most of the Taliban senior commanders, Mullah Dadullah, to you, has so far managed to escape American bullets and custody. According to the BBC correspondent, the Taliban initially wouldn't talk or meet with us, but after the first anniversary of the fall of their government, they've suddenly become very bold, gaining in confidence. Afghans in Kabul remain skeptical about the promises President Bush is making to Iraqis, the same promises he made to them of democracy, human rights, and reconstruction. The international community gave $1 billion last year to help rebuild Afghanistan. Afghans find it difficult to understand where the aid money has gone, except perhaps in Kabul, where they can see large numbers of white land cruisers, hikes in property prices, and new restaurants. In this year's budget, submitted to Congress, President Bush has recommended that, what's the figure, zero money be allocated to Afghanistan aid? Zero. Interesting round number. There's an article in one of the Sunday British papers checking on the whereabouts of, you know, I've got a sneeze, and I was just trying to kill a microphone so I could do it, but why the hell? I sneezed on the air. Is that legal? About Prime Minister Blair, Tony Blair, you know, our coalition mate. The Prime Minister decided to spend Friday recording his voice for an animated version of himself to appear in The Simpsons. Downing Street says Blair, apparently an avid fan of the biggest show to ever grace the airwaves of Rupert Murdoch's Sky and Fox TV channels, agreed to appear in the show months ago. He's a big fan of the show, says a spokesperson. He knows he might get some criticism because of the timing, doing this during the war, but this was in the diary long before the war began. The spokesperson then added, "We believe it will greatly benefit tourism and help bring Americans back to London. The Prime Minister takes every opportunity he can to promote Britain, and the script enables him to bang the drum for the tourist industry to a worldwide audience." Blair will appear in an episode of the show temporarily, I don't know, maybe it's permanently, entitled The Regina Monologues. The cartoon vision of the Prime Minister is said to come complete with stick-out ears and a fixed grin. He gives tips to Homer and the rest of the Simpson family on how to get by in Britain as tourists. The show will air in November. Al Jean, the Simpsons executive producer, visited Downing Street on Friday to record dialogue written especially for Blair. Well, it's almost like he's still at war. A few hours earlier, Blair was attending a parade at the local military academy. Jean had been on standby in his London hotel since Tuesday, waiting to record Blair's three lines. He'd previously told the press on Thursday that he had no plans to get Blair on the show, although he admitted we'd love to get him. This turned out to be a cover story to prevent a furor over the Prime Minister's strangely timed cartoon debut that might have led to the plan being called off. Now, then you wonder about the accuracy because it says George Bush Sr. has also starred in The Simpsons. Check that. Check that, please, English newspaper. I think you'll find somebody did his voice. Ladies and gentlemen, who's going to build that new Iraq? British Defense Secretary Jeff Hoon, he's a coalition mate, please. He's a Hoon, but he's a coalition mate, says it's time to allow Iraqis to start building from the bottom. Well, you deal from the bottom, why not? As members of the Ba'ath Party, the despised, loathed Ba'ath Party, are going to be used to restore order. Members of the Ba'ath Party who were loyal to Saddam Hussein are to be used to restore order in major Iraqi cities as looting and mob violence threaten to undermine coalition attempts to paint military action against him as a success. In an interview with the Sunday Observer, Defense Secretary Jeff Hoon said it was time to allow Iraqis to start building from the bottom. It was important to differentiate between Ba'athists who committed atrocities and those who had to be party members to work for the regime. So we don't have the time and the troops to guard hospitals and museums, but we do have the time and the troops to discriminate between the bad Ba'athists and the good ones, apparently. Well, that's easy. That's just a matter of... Here, you know, ladies and gentlemen, here's the trouble with Iraq. Right here, in a nutshell. In our country, if somebody wants to deface, for political or satirical reasons, a poster of a despised or loathed public figure, what do they do? What do they do with this face? They draw a mustache on it. See? The Iraqis already... You see, you can't do that to the Iraqis because it would just... Britain is planning to send a unit of armed military police to try to stabilize the situation, as well as advisors from UK police forces. Coalition forces have been accused of being ill-prepared for the violence that followed the ousting of Saddam. What we want to create as quickly as we can is an air of normality, Hoon said. The administration, although Ba'athist in that anyone who worked for the government had to be a member of the party, contained many perfectly decent people who are party members but have not participated in any atrocities and will want to go back to their work. Once the Iraqis themselves have identified who those people are, oh, there won't be any grudges there. I don't think there'll be any difficulties. Snap, babe. They had a system of administration that will deliver. He said the United Nations Oil for Food program, although corrupted by the dictatorship, showed that the country could run large bureaucratic programs. Another note on who's going to run the post-war Iraq. A U.S. military contractor accused of human rights violations has won a multi-million dollar contract to police post-Saddam Iraq. DynCorp, which has donated more than $175,000 to the Republican Party. That's table stakes, babe. Began recruiting for a private police force in Iraq, last week on behalf of the State Department. The awarding of such a sensitive contract to DynCorp has caused consternation in some circles over the company's policing record. A British employment tribunal recently forced DynCorp to pay $150,000 in compensation to a UN police officer it unfairly fired in Bosnia for whistleblowing on DynCorp colleagues involved in an illegal sex ring. That's so complicated. DynCorp paid money because it unfairly fired a UN police officer for whistleblowing his colleagues in DynCorp who were involved in an illegal sex ring. And a reporter for the Observer newspaper who contacted the firm purporting to be potential police recruit for Iraq was told it was hoping to get people on the ground in 2 to 4 weeks. The recruiter said the reporter could expect a salary of $80,000 plus hazard bonuses. He was awarded offered a contract of between 3 months and a year and told he did not need to be able to speak Arabic. He had to be a U.S. citizen who had served as a police officer in the USA. And when the reporter said he'd worked in Texas for a number of years, he was told he sounded ideal. DynCorp's advertisement is posted on a U.S. website headed Iraq Mission, stating that it was acting on behalf of the Department of State's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs. It says it's seeking individuals with appropriate experience and expertise to participate in an international effort to reestablish police justice and prison functions in post-conflict Iraq. How about all this? I'm going to sneeze again. How embarrassing is this? It's allergy season, ladies and gentlemen. How about all those people who used to work at the airport? All those people who were replaced by the TSA. They'd be perfect in Iraq because none of them speak Arabic. Speaking of contracts, the Pentagon contract given without competition to a Halliburton subsidiary to fight oil well fires in Iraq is worth as much as $7 billion over 2 years, according to a letter from the Army Corps of Engineers. The contract also allows Kellogg Brown & Root, the subsidiary, to earn as much as 7% profit. That could amount to $490 million. Of course, the question not answered by this article in the New York Times is how much of that contract gets paid even though there are no almost no oil well fires. Of course, you know Vice President Cheney was Halliburton's chief executive for 5 years. When he left the company to run for vice president, he received over $30 million in compensation. Since 9/11, Kellogg Brown & Root has won significant additional business from the federal government and the Pentagon. It built the cells for detainees at Guantanamo Bay and is the exclusive logistics supplier for the Navy and the Army, providing services like cooking, construction, power generation, and fuel transportation. Ask your doctor. The administration says these contracts and all other contracts to rebuild Iraq were awarded without any comment from Cheney or anyone else in the White House, like they need to comment. Lieutenant General Robert Flowers, the commander of the Corps of Engineers, says Kellogg Brown & Root was chosen because it was the only contractor considered capable of developing what he called complex classified contingency plans, that would be the three C's, and then to carry them out on extremely short notice. No other contractor could satisfy mission requirements in the time available, he wrote. That's why they didn't put the contract out for bid. You see, ladies and gentlemen. So, there's a website already devoted to the former deposed Iraqi information minister, the guy who said there were no American infidels in Baghdad, while on a split screen we saw American infidels in Baghdad. But what about Tariq Aziz? He was perhaps the most familiar public face of the old regime. Well, ladies and gentlemen, reviving an old Le Show feature for 1 week only, Hot Property, For sale, Riverside residence slightly looted, one careful Christian Baptist owner whereabouts unknown. Likely to be finding alternative accommodation shortly. Behind the high walls, this is from the Times of London, behind the high walls of the palatial villa in Baghdad's affluent Al-Jarariya district, the white window latticework combining the eight-pointed Ba'ath Party star with the Christian cross immediately points to Tariq Aziz. In a charred heap outside the front door lies a biography of Colin Powell and an Arabic-language Bible. At the top of the steps, marble of course, is an empty box of the veteran diplomat's favorite Romeo y Julieta Churchill cigars. U.S. Marines have already removed most of the sensitive contents of the house after blowing the safe on Wednesday night to take away files and bundles of paper for analysis, but plenty remains within the now-devastated three-story building, which cost him 217,000 Iraqi dinars in 1987. Alongside of biographies of Saddam, the library includes countless profiles in English of U.S. presidents and leading politicians, including Jimmy Carter, Cyrus Vance, Nixon, Reagan, and Kissinger, and a British documentary, Inside Iran. Victory Without War by Richard Nixon. Aziz's videos are even more interesting. Anthony Hopkins is Nixon, Woody Allen's Manhattan, Hitchcock's North by Northwest, and a box set of The Godfather. Music includes Tchaikovsky's Recollections of Florence by the Borodin Quartet, a Frank Sinatra album, Russian Gypsy songs, and Diana Ross. Downstairs, the fine cellar has been stripped of all but a few boxes, which indicate that Chivas Regal, Grand Old Par, and Jerez Brandy were his chosen drinks. Gone are his Pierre Cardin shoes, Vostok military watch, and Spanish Rima shoes. Tariq Aziz's home, ladies and gentlemen, available probably for a viewing whenever you can get there.
It's just that kind of day. It's time to kick on back, toss your cares away. Cartwheels and piggybacks, it's just that kind of day. Tell me no, Mr. Blues, he's welcome here no more. Put on your happy shoes and chase him out the door.
Today when I awoke, all my cares went up in smoke. I thought about the sad-eyed folk who
never heard this song.
Your heart.
The sun's a circus clown, the moon's a lemon tart. I'm sitting on a hill, watching clouds at play. Love clouds, I always will. It's just that kind of day.
Today when I awoke, all my cares went up in smoke.
I thought about the sad-eyed folk who never
heard this song.
Let's give ourselves a break from sorrow and dismay. The world's a birthday cake. It's just that kind of day. It's just that kind of day. It's just that kind of day.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Fog Watch. You know, because war is such a foggy deal. The American troops who suggested this week they may have uncovered evidence of an active nuclear weapons program in Iraq. That made headlines on Fox, the Fog News Channel. Unwittingly may have stumbled across known stocks of low-grade uranium, officials said late this week. They said the U.S. troops, in fact, may have broken UN seals meant to keep control of the radioactive material. New tests indicate that substances found at sites in central Iraq are not chemical weapons agents, as first suspected, U.S. military sources said. The latest test turned out negative. Tests on substances found near the central Iraqi town of Hindiya suggested the presence of nerve agents sarin and tabin and the blister agent lewisite. Military sources said it's not yet clear what they were. One officer said they might turn out to be simple pesticides. And remember those bodies, those hideously stacked bodies in simple boxes that were found in a warehouse a couple weeks ago? Proof of the brutality of the regime. Well, it was a brutal regime, no doubt about that. But those remains of 200 people found by British troops in a barrack near Basra are those of Iranian soldiers killed in the Iran-Iraq war. The remains were scheduled to be repatriated to Iran, but the repatriation did not proceed because the war against Iraq started. Makeshift coffins and plastic bags. Faded photos of corpses showing signs of torture and execution, but that was, ladies and gentlemen, that was war. And now, another exclusive feature of this broadcast, the Apologies of the Week. Yes, we have so many of them. I'm just getting them together here. Geraldo Rivera says he's sorry for breaking the military's rules for journalists by outlining planned troop movements in the sand. The correspondent in Kuwait delivered his apology on the air last Sunday night. He has said a review of his report while traveling with the 101st Airborne Division last week, quote, showed I did indeed break one of the rules related to embedment. I'm sorry that it happened, and I assure you it was inadvertent, Rivera said. Nobody was hurt by what I said. No mission was compromised. I should have been more careful, he said. His statement was in contrast to his bravado last week when he labeled reports that he'd been ousted a pack of lies spread by some rats at NBC. Now, last night, Saturday night, as this broadcast is being aired, Rivera was back in Baghdad with the 101st. So he re-embedded himself. How did that happen? How does a guy who violates military regulations for embedment re-embed? Last week on this broadcast, we asked how did the Fox negotiate his voluntary removal from Iraq after he had violated those rules. Now, this broadcast asks, how did they get him back? How did they re-embed him? Dateline Ottawa. Canada, I think, is becoming the national capital of apologies. An apology was issued by Gamal Soleiman, the Ottawa imam, who called on Muslims across the Middle East to take up arms in a holy war against American troops in Iraq. He issued the apology after the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration said he intended to conduct an investigation into the inflammatory comments. Quote, during my recent interview with Global Television, which, by the way, can only be seen in a few areas of Canada, hence the name, I made certain remarks concerning the situation in Iraq. I do not support or promote violence in any form against any country or any group of people, Mr. Soleiman wrote. He continued, I deeply regret and sincerely apologize for my comments and the hurt which it may have caused. I hope and pray that peace would prevail in all regions of the world. However, an amended apology was issued on the same letterhead. Instead of I deeply and sincerely apologize for my comments and the hurt which it may have caused, it now reads, I deeply regret and sincerely apologize for my misunderstood comments. Blame the media. Also in Canada, John Baird, a senior cabinet minister, delivered an abject apology this week, hours after he joked about SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, and its apparent Asian origins. Mr. Baird, the Ontario Minister of Energy, started the controversy when he mockingly coughed as he entered a pre-cabinet press meeting, prompting one journalist to quip that the government's new communications strategy was to give the media SARS. Said the minister in response, "I enjoyed my trip to Asia." Demands for his resignation followed. He said he was sorry. "My comments this morning were stupid, they were thoughtless, they were insensitive, and I apologize. I should have known better," he told reporters. Did the reporters misunderstand that? Dateline Tallahassee, Florida. Three-term legislator apologized to members of the Florida House after making a joke stereotyping blacks as superior basketball players. He later apologized to each black member of the House and then apologized to the entire chamber. Representative Fred Brummer, a white Republican. "He is so sorry." A Wyoming congresswoman apologized Wednesday after a colleague complained her House floor comments linked blacks and drug use. Representative Barbara Cuban, Republican of Wyoming, was accused of being racially insensitive during debate over whether to prohibit lawsuits from being brought against gun and ammunition manufacturers. Cuban, who supports the bill to protect the manufacturers from lawsuits, was complaining about a failed Democratic amendment that would have banned gun sales to drug addicts. "So does that mean if you go into a black community, you can't sell any guns to any black person?" she asked. She apologized for offending sensitivity, saying she was sorry if her words offended anyone. But she refused to have her words removed from the record. And Dateline Hollywood, Florida, a city commissioner has apologized for warning residents that, quote, "you will have a pervert or a homosexual living next to you if the city allows another adult entertainment business to open." Sal Oliveri apologized to a small group of gay residents and said he understands homosexuality has nothing to do with pornography. Well, I wouldn't say that. Dateline Dublin, one of Ireland's prominent campaigners for the rights of victims of clerical sexual abuse, settled a 5-year-old case against the Roman Catholic Diocese where he was abused more than 20 years ago. For $323,000 in a deal that included a public apology from the Catholic Church. And finally, the head of the Baseball Hall of Fame hasn't apologized yet, but he regrets canceling a screening of Bull Durham because he was ticked off at Tim Robbins for his anti-war views. And Dateline Philadelphia, a Washington Township man who said he was personally offended by the song War that was played during the Philadelphia Phillies' final sold-out home opener at Veterans Stadium, got an apology from the organization that promised never to play the song again. Michael Mellis called the playing of the tune Edwin Starr made a hit in the 70s inappropriate and a shameful move by the Phillies organization when it decided to play it during the fan-related event. He asked for an apology not only from the Phillies but from Citizens Bank, the sponsor of the video clip segment. The Phillies apologized, saying the songs for the 70s were chosen because of the segment featuring video clips of what was called the Phillies and Pirates, a decade of battles, and the choice of the song was for the rivalry he called baseball wars and not the current war in Iraq. Said Mellis, "How can you compare a rivalry between two teams as a war when there's a real war going on?" Mellis says, quote, "How can they say a public apology was unwarranted? I'm doing this because I'm an American. The letter I got makes me feel like they think I'm an oddball. I am sure there is more people out there who have an opinion, but who haven't said anything." Coincidentally, Edwin Starr died last week.
CNN coverage of the war in Iraq continues with a special edition of Larry King Live. Now, here's Larry King Live.
We're in Lexington, Kentucky tonight, where I'll be emceeing the Mint Julep Ball for the benefit of the Pulmonary Edema Foundation Monday night. Coming up next hour, our own Aaron Brown discusses his anxieties about the war with Dr. Phil. But right now, in a Los Angeles studio, an old friend of Larry King Live, even though he's young enough to be my son from my fifth marriage. He first hit the spotlight with the boy band Boys R Us. He's been on his own now for a couple of years, building a solo career. And he's with us tonight because, well, he's going to tell us why he's here tonight. That's why he's here. The fabulous Dewey Gordon.
Good evening, Larry. Thanks for having me back. Yeah. I know it's wartime, and I'm no general or journalist or anything.
Well, you know, Dewey, I think people want to know about the effect of the war on the ordinary celebrity even more.
Well, I hope so, Larry. Yeah. As you know, I don't think an artist has to keep his heart off his sleeve all the time. I think you remember I was involved in the whole post 9/11 patriotism thing before it was even a bandwagon. So
no, your song "Where's Your Flag" was topping the charts right up till the promotion money ran out.
That's right. But I haven't felt, Larry, as an artist and as a person of the human persuasion, that it was my job to inject my opinion about the war in Iraq into this very, very tense atmosphere. You know, my job was to finish my new record, A Kick in the Heart, and just to get it out to the people.
The record's out this week?
Next week.
Okay, and you're going to do a song from it here tonight? I didn't think we were doing that during the war.
No, and I appreciate that policy, too. No, Larry, I only wish I were here to lip-sync a number from the record, but frankly, I'm a little scared about what's going on, and I just wanted to share that fear with your viewers.
Yeah, is this about the fear of traveling with the terrorism and the virus and the cutbacks?
No, sure, Larry. You know, that Janine Garofalo and the Dixie Chicks and Tim Robbins, you know, they've been concerned that there might be a blowback effect on their careers from coming out publicly against the war.
Susan Sarandon's going to be on our show Tuesday night, a whole panel of successful actresses over 40.
That sounds great. Yeah. But by the same token, you know, we've had some folks, the great Phil Hendry, the radio host here in Hollywood, concerned that his public pro-war stance might endanger his new NBC pilot.
I hear it's a funny show. I read that in my column.
So, we know it might be going both ways, this very un-American intolerance of an opposing view. But, Larry, sir, here's what I'm feeling, that my very refusal to take a public position may be boomeranging back on my career and on the reception of my new album.
You mean radio stations are boycotting it?
Well, we don't know that for sure. It's a little hard to measure because they were kind of cool about the last release as well. But we're hearing some things.
Yeah, some chatter?
Exactly. Yeah. And it suggests that, you know, certain people in the industry think I'm being unpatriotic or cowardly or something because I'm not taking a stand.
Dewey, is it that you don't got an opinion on the war, or you do, but you don't want to reveal it yet? Or, you know, what?
As I say, Larry, I don't think it's my job to, you know, weigh in on all that. My job, if you'll pardon my French, is just to make a lot of female booties break out in a cold sweat.
And you don't think as a citizen and a beloved public figure you have a responsibility to have an opinion, you know, good or bad?
I really don't. I mean, this is America, Larry. A lot of young guys, braver and better looking than me, have fought and died for our right to not have an opinion. You know, if we start making people afraid to not speak out, I hate to say it, but the terrorists have won.
Yeah. Well, Dewey, what does your record company think?
Well, as you know, Larry, recording executives are some of the smartest, most passionate people around. They're going to support me no matter what I do as long as I move units. But there's just so much they can do, you know, because of the RICO statutes.
No, sure, their hands are tied.
Because, you know, I had a series that was being very seriously looked at the USA Network. It's EMR, Emergency Medical Rescue. I'm a paramedic who's in extreme sports.
And you think that's in trouble now because of your non-stand?
Well, all I know is it's weird. You know, we were talking to these people for months, and suddenly nothing.
These are television executives you're talking about?
That's what I mean. It's weird. Mm. So, who knows, but I just wanted to go public about all this to say to my fans, what we've had is bigger than any war, and I hope they're not going to hold my stand about not taking a stand against me, and not only me, but all the hundreds of artists and craftsmen that contributed to this record. Yeah. I mean, you know, Larry, I sound good, but I don't sound that good. That takes a lot of help.
Yeah, we're seeing a new humility in the Dewey Gordon of 2003. Some people might say you've grown up.
I hope so, Larry. It's what it's all about.
The great Dewey Gordon in our Los Angeles studio tonight. Next time we have you on the show, Dewey, please come do a song from Kickin' the Heart.
That's a promise, Larry.
Coming up, the great Christian Amanpour about looking your best while you're embedded. We'll be right back.
Larry King Live is brought to you by Archer Manuel Diddley, drugstore to the world.
More news from the rear, ladies and gentlemen, because this is Le Show. Says Dr. Ahmed Uthman, an Iraqi-born Kurd and retired University of Buffalo dental professor. He had very good teeth, excellent teeth. He's recalling the time he treated Saddam Hussein. He examined Saddam just once. He said he would have no difficulty recognizing the interior of Saddam's mouth again because he had a rare periodontal condition, an impacted canine tooth on the upper right. So be on the lookout, ladies and gentlemen. Here's a tip. Yes, we do public service. Of course we do. Of course, while we're all concentrating on the war, some people take advantage to do things they wouldn't want noticed. You notice Fidel Castro arrested a lot of dissidents. Sharing nothing but timing, I guess. The House of Representatives has voted to limit lawsuits against gun manufacturers. And here in Los Angeles, the home of the homeless, actually not in Santa Monica, but in Southern California, an ex-FBI agent is accused of passing secrets to his lover, a Chinese woman who passed them on to the Chinese government. A double agent at the FBI, go figure. And also in Los Angeles, to finally get rid of that nagging publicity problem connecting to South Central, you know, where they've had riots, the city this week announced, no, not a rebuilding program. We tried that. Not a boost in funds to the schools. I'm sure we've tried that. No, the city announced this week that South Central Los Angeles will henceforth be known as South Los Angeles. Iraqi justice, this is from the San Francisco Chronicle. Iraqi justice may have been a cruel oxymoron under Saddam Hussein, but the system of courts and laws distorted by his 24-year rule is fundamentally sound, according to legal experts. And with remarkably few changes, it can effectively serve the rights of individuals and the demands of a modern economy. A more difficult issue is whether officials planning the shape of post-war Iraq can find judges and lawyers competent to make the system work. Most current court officers are Hussein loyalists or complicit in the abuses of the dictator's regime, experts say. So replacements must come either from the hundreds of Iraqi attorneys in exile or retirement, or from the legal communities of other Arab nations, or elsewhere.
Hello, Cochran.
Johnny, my erstwhile colleague, my quondam brother-in-arms, it's Lee Bailey. How are you, sir?
F. Lee, my golly, I haven't heard from you since you were, yeah. I mean, you know, since the, since O.J. moved to Florida.
Yes, sir, many interesting things happen in the Sunshine State. Almost makes you think. And you, sir, you've enjoyed remarkable success in the interim. The television shows, the work with Al Sharpton.
Well, I just wanted to see firsthand what the gentleman does to his hair. Uh-huh. I mean, that look is far more difficult for an African-American than dreadlocks are for a white individual.
Well, I'm sure that's true, Johnny, although I had no reason to know why I possess that degree of certitude.
And, of course, since I got out of the practice of law per se, the consultancy thing has gone through the roof.
Yes, I too got out of the practice of law, Jonathan, as you may well know, but it was at the heavy hand of the federal government, and nothing discourages the potential consultancy client like the whiff of disbarment.
Well, Lee, I was genuinely sorry to hear about that, I've got a lunch with the Frito-Lay people. They're very anxious to make Fritos more ethnically friendly.
I take your meaning, Cochran, so let me truncate the persiflage and cut to the core of the colloquy.
Please.
Well, I've heard that via the grapevine that there is, or soon will be, a need for lawyers to staff the Iraqi legal system. Have you read an item of such import?
Well, actually, Lee, I have, and you know, the first thing I thought.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you. It was thinking.
Hey, Geraldo's over there already. He's got a law degree. He could broadcast live from his own trial. Uh-huh. I think that's one of his dreams.
Yeah.
You know, of course, the other one is being in a threesome with Halle Berry and
Geraldo, as we both know, is a bit of a showboat. And while a touch of showmanship is absolutely essential to maintain the jury in a state of non-somnolence, I don't think you have to surrender completely to Barnum.
HB?
PT.
Oh, I'm sure he's a dynamite arranger, too, but
The point of the colloquy, Mr. C, is whether you could use your contacts over there to say, in effect and in essence, I know this Lee Bailey, and the disbarment is valid just for the state of Florida. He'd be a remarkable addition to any new legal team in Baghdad or for a negligible bonus in Basra.
Lee, I have no contacts east of Dar es Salaam. There's no way I can...
Johnny, please, don't give the bootblack a shinola job. I've seen the Iraqis on television, although since the contretemps with the federal juggernaut, I've had to do without the dichotomous blessings of cable, but so many of the Iraqis are clearly, as the modern phrase has it, people of color. They're third world, even though they seem to have more cars per capita than the southwestern quadrant of Miami. And by the same token, our prisons are filled to overflowing with fellows of a Muslim persuasion, a goodly number of them defended by yourself and or members of your firm.
Lee, what are you looking for? Private practice? Prosecuting attorney? Civil? I wouldn't think there'd be a market for that yet, but, you know, maybe you could be Iraq's first tobacco lawyer.
Johnny, without adumbrating an unnecessary cohort of indicia of desperation, let me just say, whatever you can do, brother, it will be appreciated, not to say reciprocated on the extremely unlikely occasion that our positions are reversed.
Oh, hey, you never know. I mean, look what happened to Nancy Grace. Mm-hmm. Let me see what I can do, Lee, and I'll have Cherie in my office get back to you.
All right.
Do you ever talk to Juice?
He calls me when he's trying to sober up. He sounds nostalgic for the old days.
The football?
The first trial. Anyway, Johnny, I look forward to hearing your tidings. But be of good cheer, sir.
Oh, I am. You take care, Lee.
You too, sir.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. Before I sneeze anymore, got to get out of here. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, dropped by leaflets over Baghdad. I don't think we do that yet with this broadcast. Up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, across all of North America via Sirius satellite radio, and on your computer whenever you want it at two locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And it'd be just like Geraldo broadcasting his own trial if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty. Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. And through that address, you can also subscribe to our periodic and very low-impact newsletter. Yeah, it actually works. And it never sneezes. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, the satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. We're just about 20 miles northwest of South Los Angeles, and it's a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.